Good morning, and thank you all for being here for the opening of our summer 2006 Shela Ango. At this center, we divide the year into four unequal parts. There are 2 4-month periods, the Prajna Angos, and 2 2-month periods, the Shela Angos. Prajna is transcendent wisdom, and during the Prajna Ango, we emphasize intense introspection, zazen, turning inward to discover the origin of the self and all that that implies. Shela means virtue or morality, and today we begin the Shela Ango, during which we turn outward to see how prajna plays out in our lives. I believe I remarked during one of these talks a couple of years ago that during Sesshin, the 7-day meditation retreat, we expand the zendo to include the entire temple, and that during the Shela Ango, we attempt, at least, to expand the temple to include the world. That is to say that nowhere in our lives is there a place that is not a place of practice. Thus, the emphasis is not so much on deep penetration practice as in spreading our practice laterally, as it were, to all facets of our lives. Now, this is usually thought of as working with our normal daily activities, work, family, interaction with others, and so on. But today I'd like to address another and perhaps more overt way of taking practice off the mat into the world, using one small aspect of my own attempt to do this. I'm one of those who sit zazen in front of the Colorado State Capitol building on Wednesday mornings from 7:30 to 8:30. This is a peace vigil sponsored by the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Members and others sit in silence under a banner that reads, "May all beings attain peace." And a few signs are placed in the lawn depicting the effects and costs of war. Anyone may join the group for any amount of time. On some mornings, especially if the weather is not good, there are just two of us, our teacher, Dane and Henry Roshi, and myself. One day, Roshi and I were walking from my van toward the west lawn of the Capitol, hauling our little grocery carts filled with a banner, tarpaulin, blanket, signs, and zafus. And Roshi remarked that this was really the only kind of protest that he felt comfortable doing, to simply sit in peaceful silence. This struck a very strong chord with me, because I've not always been clear myself as to why I do this vigil. And it made me start to think seriously about my own feelings toward the war in Iraq, war in general, and what protest is all about. There are times when it is quite pleasant to sit silently as the sun rises behind the Capitol, the traffic picks up, people walk by, and there's the general noise and bustle of a city beginning of the day. Some of those driving by honk and wave the peace sign. Others honk and wave half the peace sign, if you know what I mean. But it's all fine. Other days when it's raining or snowing, cold and damp, and I'm shivering in spite of the many layers I'm wearing, my nose is runny and my hands and feet are numb, it's at times like that that I ask myself, what the heck am I doing here? But when I ask, why am I doing this? I don't have a really good answer. Not a short one, anyway. Why do I do it? Well, I'm sitting with my friends, for one thing. But am I thinking that this will somehow stop the war, this current war or any other? No, I do not believe that a small number of people sitting in a peace vigil here in Colorado will deflect one bullet, stop one bomb, or prevent the death of one innocent. Not in the usual sense, anyway. Am I protesting the war in Iraq? Well, maybe. Am I protesting war in general? Probably. Actually, I'm not completely sure that I'm protesting anything. This may put me at odds with some of the other folks I'm sitting with. So what am I doing then? The closest thing would be to say that I'm bearing witness. Well, bearing witness to what? To suffering? To whose suffering? Your suffering. My suffering. The suffering of the people of Iraq. The suffering of the American military people over there. The suffering of the families of those who have died, Iraqi, American, British. The suffering of those in Sudan, Botswana, Rwanda, Cambodia, Vietnam, Peru, Chile, Guatemala. The victims of senseless shootings on the streets of Denver. Those in nursing homes, old, helpless, or nearly so, often abandoned. Taking an hour a week to specifically and consciously bear witness to suffering is little enough. Yet it all sounds very grandiose. But if I do this, how can I not bear witness to all suffering? How can I bear witness to the suffering of only this or that favored group, but not some other group because I don't happen to like them? Or I don't consider them to be politically correct. If I make such distinctions, what is this bearing witness really worth? Other than sitting every week at the state capitol, I've not been involved in other aspects of the peace movement. This is partly because of some personal obligations, but also I have great difficulty with much of the peace movement as it currently presents itself in this country. And that is its increasing stridency and anger. I believe that Michael Moore, Cindy Sheehan, and their various followers have done enormous harm with their vituperation toward the president and the current administration. I don't see that that kind of vitriolic language is in any way conducive to peace. It doesn't seem to me to be so much about peace as about indulging in anger. It's contradictory that a peace movement should be so unpeaceable in its language and behavior. I got the same feeling recently watching a local production of a play called The War Anthology. It was a series of vignettes by different authors concerning war and its effects on people, either directly or indirectly. There were some parts that were very poignant, grieving families, dead children and soldiers both living and dead. But one part that I found most disturbing was a very long piece, in which the First Lady, Laura Bush, was presented as a grotesque caricature of the quintessentially stupid Texas redneck. The indulgence in anger expressed either in language or behavior simply generates the same level of anger in the opposition, in this case, those who favor the war. a kind of Newtonian law of emotions. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Mohandas Gandhi, the Mahatma, who I think we can acknowledge knew a thing or two about nonviolent religious resistance, was very clear about two things. First, you do not insult, vilify, ridicule, or embarrass your adversary. Second, you must accord to your adversary the same high motives that you claim for yourself. I don't see either of these criteria being met or even considered by the vast majority of the current peace movement. It is certainly not demonstrated by holding up a photograph of the president with a Hitler-like mustache drawn on it. Gandhi led the most extraordinary peaceful revolution in history. He stood up against the might of the British Empire. He was detested by many in the British government, including Winston Churchill. Yet he was still able to sit down with Lord Mountbatten and hammer out the details of the British withdrawal from India. Martin Luther King Jr. led the most successful peaceful revolution in American history. Yet he was able to meet with President Lyndon Johnson, the ultimate Texas good old boy, and work out the civil rights legislation. I don't see any public figure or leader in the current peace movement who could or would sit down with President Bush and have any kind of meaningful discussion. And that, to me, does not seem like a peace movement. There is a very powerful story of the Buddha that I brought out before, and I'm relating it again in a slightly different version. The Buddha was a member of the Shakya clan in northern India, the general area of modern Nepal. Another kingdom, the Magadha clan, was the nearest neighbor. In fact, Bodh Gaya, the place where the Buddha attained his supreme enlightenment, is in Magadha country. For the most part, relations between the two kingdoms were good. But at one time, when the Buddha was in his early 50s, a terrible diplomatic faux pas was committed by the Shakyas against the Magadhas. The Magadha king had requested an alliance between the two kingdoms by marrying his son to a woman of the Shakya nobility. But the Shakyas sent a serving maid instead. When this substitution was found out, the Magadha king was furious, and he determined to make war on the Shakya. So he gathered his army and marched toward the border. But when he got there, the Buddha was standing in the road. Now, in those days, it was absolutely forbidden for an army to march if a holy man stood in its path. So the Magadha king had to turn back. But not too much later, still furious, the king and his army marched again. And again the Buddha stood in his path. Three times the Buddha stopped the Magadha army in this way. But the fourth time he stood aside and allowed the Magadha king and his army to proceed into the Shakya lands and decimate the clan. Without saying a word, the Buddha just sat and watched as his country and his people were being destroyed. He did not join in the battle. Even though he had been trained as a warrior as a young man, he did not ride to the rescue. He stood aside. The Buddha did not stop the war. Historically, the Magadha went on to dominate most of northern India, swallowing up the smaller kingdoms. Was the Buddha then a failure? Quite a few years ago, one of the larger peace groups staged a demonstration against the continuing use of Rocky Flats weapon plant as a production facility for nuclear triggers for hydrogen bombs. The idea was to get enough people out there to hold hands in a line and completely surround the plant, a distance of nearly 20 miles. My wife Candy and I went out there and joined with some others from Denver and from elsewhere around the state. Later on the evening news, it was reported that there hadn't been quite enough people to complete the circle. The right-wing radio pundits crowed that the demonstration was therefore a failure. If it was a failure, then so are just about all the protests, rallies, demonstrations, vigils, and letters to the editor against the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the wars in Africa, starvation and death in Darfur. Our ceremonies of aid that we hold here periodically are failures. Bernie Glassman's street session, in which a group of people spend a week living as homeless people on the streets of New York or other large cities, do not end homelessness and are therefore failures. If we are attached to a particular goal, such as stopping a war, stopping the production of bombs, ending homelessness, hunger, or just getting enough people out there, then all these attempts have failed even before they are begun. Karma is what makes up our lives in this world of time, space, and suffering. The Buddha could have stood there and stopped the Magadha army for the rest of his life and done nothing else, and the bloodshed and the further conquests would still have taken place at some point. That karma was going to play itself out eventually, regardless of what the Buddha did or didn't do. In this can-do culture, we have enormous difficulty in accepting the fact of karma, which is just another term for that which is. We want instant gratification. If we don't get what we want by talking, we start shouting. If we still don't get what we want, we start screaming. The rhetoric goes up and up and up, driven by an increasing sense of failure into an attitude of by any means necessary, including violence. And when none of it works, exhaustion sets in, and many simply give up and go on to other things that might have a greater chance of providing gratification. When the peace vigils at the Capitol first started, there were often a dozen or more people sitting there for all or part of that hour. Now, if there are four or five, we think it's a huge crowd. To pursue anything, even peace, in this conceptual, one-sided way is to inevitably pursue its opposite. After all, if that is the kind of peace we want, how can it exist except in relation to war? How can harmony exist except in relation to discord? How can plenty exist in relation to poverty? How can joy exist except in relation to sorrow? What is it then to sit on the Capitol lawn on Wednesdays? What is it to gather in Washington, D.C.? What is it to form a line around Rocky Flats? What is it to write letters to senators and representatives? It is to bear witness. Real peace, the Buddha's peace, is bearing witness. This is the peace that does not stand against no peace, any more than not knowing a Bodhidharma stands against knowing. To practice this peace, to be truly peaceful, is to bear witness to the Buddha's peace, which does not exclude. It is to go to the heart of suffering. To go to the heart of suffering is about two things: awareness and non-separation. As the Shakya clan was being decimated, the Buddha did not turn away. He ignored nothing. He stood and watched the slaughter of his own people. Without that, he could not bear witness. Bearing witness is not just about emitting fuzzy good feelings or burying one's head in the sand. Awareness is a crucial part of bearing witness, and not just some general awareness of suffering. Yes, suffering is the first noble truth. Life is suffering, blah, blah, blah. But a very specific case-by-case awareness. This is the really hard part. On a more or less regular basis, I check the media, especially the alternative news sources, about what is really going on in the world. It is one of the most difficult things that I do. When I read or listen to accounts of government-sponsored kidnap torture, euphemistically referred to as extraordinary rendition, the slaughter of innocent people, whether by suicide bombers or missiles or F-18s, euphemistically referred to as acceptable collateral damage, the indefinite imprisonment of people in black sites in Eastern Europe or in Guantanamo, I have to deal with the anger, outrage, sorrow, fear that it all brings up. And when I visit my wife at the nursing home, there are times when it is all I can do to not to weep. The one thing I cannot do is ignore. You cannot bear witness out of ignorance. You have to face that to which you would bear witness. You must face it steadily, unflinchingly, without anger, fear, or malice, or at least do the best you can. But at the same time, there can be no separation. You must not let yourself become armored. In that moment of battle, the Buddha was the horror and the dying. He was the murdered children, the dismembered corpses. He was the fury of the Magadha king and of his warriors. He was the swords, the spears, and the blood-soaked earth. At that moment, his being, his practice, was the massacre. He went to the heart of suffering. The suffering replaced him, even as did the morning star. There was nothing else. Dogen said, "The sun, moon, stars, and the great wide earth are none other than my own self." Well, the suicide bombers, their victims, their families, and the victims' families, the Columbine shooters, the students cowering in the cafeteria, their families, the 100-year-old woman dozing in her wheelchair, her children who have abandoned her, are also none other than my own self. I cannot pursue, I cannot avoid, I can only bear witness. In his book, Returning to Silence, Dainen Katagiri writes, "How then can we achieve real peace? According to Shakyamuni Buddha, real peace is completely beyond whether there is a way to stop the king from attacking or not. He didn't say anything, but his sitting was perfect peace, real peace that he could create from moment to moment. Shakyamuni Buddha manifested himself as real peace beyond any discussion of peace." There are several koans that are very much about bearing witness. How do you stop suffering? How do you save a ghost? From where you sit, stop the sound of that distant bell. Peace, like our Zazen, is a practice without goals, desires, or expected results. The first transformation in the practice of peace is not in the world, but in ourselves. This does not always mean passivity. When the Buddha could act, he acted. He stood at the border and stopped an army. When he could no longer act, he stood. In both cases, he was bearing witness. Now, if you're expecting me to provide a scheme, a discussion of strategy and tactics, I will have to disappoint you. This is not about what you do. It's about what is behind it. If there is real compassion and awareness behind it, then you can rally, carry signs, chant, sing, or sit there, and there will be an impact. If there is no compassion, if there's anger, resentment, a desire to do something or change something, then that same action is useless and worse than useless. This working for peace, real peace, this practice of peace goes by many names: compassion, bearing witness, speaking truth to power, nonviolent resistance. I like the word coined by Gandhi, satyagraha, holding to the truth, truth here in the deepest sense. Satyagraha expresses itself in many ways, depending on time, place, and circumstance, and we cannot predict in advance what it will look like or how it will happen. Three Dominican nuns, Ardeth Platt, Jackie Hudson, and Carol Gilbert, broke into a missile site near Greeley, Colorado, on October 6, 2002, smeared their own blood on a silo cover and tapped at it with little bitty hammers. For this, they were convicted of obstructing the national defense and damaging government property. U.S. District Judge Robert Blackburn sentenced these women variously to 30 to 41 months in federal prison. Blackburn further stated that by their actions, these three women, all of whom were middle-aged or older, were dangerously irresponsible and had placed the U.S. armed forces in harm's way. What? The prosecution demanded jail time in order to teach them a lesson. Well, there certainly was a lesson in that fiasco, but not, I think, the one that the government lawyers anticipated or wanted. The manner in which these three women accepted and served their sentences with good cheer and equanimity, as abundantly attested to by their letters from prison, was and is an extraordinary teaching. They were smiling and cheerful and utterly non-threatening. And they were not threatened. The whole incident demonstrated more powerfully than any possible verbal statement that the evil that certain government authorities ascribed to these three was in fact their own delusion. The lesson that the government intended to teach these women by imposing harsh prison sentences was turned completely on its head. These three did what the Buddha did. They stood in the road and bore witness. And not just in their original act of civil disobedience, but throughout the entire process of arrest, trial, conviction, sentencing, and jail time. They held to the truth. They spoke truth to power, and they did it with peace, compassion, and even joy. The lesson I got from all that, and the lesson I suspect most of us learned, was that love, compassion, the Buddha's peace, the peace of Christ, satyagraha, or whatever you call it, surpasses the combined might of the entire U.S. military. I don't believe that they were doing all this in order to just feel good about themselves. They already felt fine. They felt so fine they were able to take extraordinary action, appropriate action. They did what they did as an offering and a sacrifice. What they did came out of their own religious experience and deep faith. Therefore, it was unique to them. Whatever each one of us does must come from that same place and therefore be unique to each of us, who we are in our practice and faith. This is how anti-war protesters and all of us must approach our actions, as an offering and a sacrifice. Whether or not that offering is accepted, whether or not it makes a difference, is not our business. To attach to the notion that I'm going to change things, or I'm going to make things better, or I'm going to make things the way I want them, is a setup for failure, discouragement, frustration, and even violence. To bear witness is and must be a spiritual act. And a truly spiritual act has no goal beyond itself. Meister Eckhart said, "To give 100 marks to build a cathedral is great. To give 100 marks for nothing is greater." Katagiri writes, "No matter how long we emphasize the need for real peace to all beings, there are still many individuals who don't accept our peace. If people don't accept our peace, where can it be found? Peace has to be found in us. This is why Shakyamuni Buddha watched his native country being destroyed. No one accepted his peace. So finally, real peace came back to Buddha himself. There is no other way." This is the difference between real peace as spiritual practice and the worldly peace that comes out of cause and effect calculations and cost-benefit analysis. A few of us sit at the Capitol on Wednesday mornings and have done so for a couple of years now. And we don't know for sure, but perhaps in that time only one person driving by or walking by on his or her way to work hesitated and thought for a brief moment, "What is that all about, I wonder?" Then we have made a difference to that one person, or again perhaps to no one. But that is enough. Or as Bernie Glassman might put it, we will never accomplish peace in this world. That is why we have to keep working at it. So there it is. As best as I can say in words, that is why I sit at the Capitol for an hour on Wednesday mornings. I bear witness as best I can to suffering, to your suffering, my suffering, the suffering of all beings, for being itself is suffering. It's a poor reflection of the Buddha's peace, but it's the best I can do. There is no other way. If it is a way within you or appeals to you, but only if, then I invite you to join us from time to time, whenever you can. It gets a bit lonely out there sometimes. We would be glad of your company. Together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood.